think you're special. You do. I can see it in your eyes. I can see it when you laugh at me. Look down on me and walk around on me. Just one.
Hello and welcome to possibly the most redundant episode of Must See Matches, the essentials of pro wrestling as nominated by you. This week we are talking about Stone Cold Steve Austin versus The Rock from WrestleMania 17, April the 1st, 2001. And to be honest, I don't know what we can say about this match that hasn't already been said, but we're going to try anyway. I am Kieran Lefort, and joining me as always, my co-host, the man behind Must See Matches, Mark Buckley. Mark, how you doing?
Yeah, not bad, thanks. I'm good.
Excellent. And joining us is the man who flat out insisted we check out his melody from Days of Thunder. Dave Ryan is back. Dave, how are you?
I'm pretty good. You know what I like about this show is that you find the real unheralded gems of professional wrestling and bring me to talk about them. Real sleeper hits.
I'm like, what can we... This must be one of the most discussed matches of all time. What can we possibly add to this?
It was the real mixed bag of, like, you messaged me and said, hey, do you want to talk about Austin The Rock at WrestleMania 17? I was like, hell yeah. And as soon as we finished talking, I was like, oh, shit. It's like my other appearances on the show, I'm like, oh, there's angles of my personal experience watching this, but I'm just like, this is the most, like, hive mind, everyone agrees on it match I've maybe ever talked out loud about.
I'm going to make the broad assumption that we were all just watching the product at this point, because it was hot as hell.
Yeah.
And it's one of those periods in wrestling history that's just... I mean, I'll kind of get to it at the end, but this is like the end of turmoil, if you like, because ECW had its final show in January. Mm-hmm. The final Nitro was 6 days before this show. And the final Worldwide, which is officially the final WCW TV show, aired the night before this. Mm-hmm. So WCW has only just died. WWF has only just won. And like, that you've gone from three national promotions to one.
Yeah. Simulcast was the go home show.
Jesus. Like,
actually, that might be one of the most discussed things of all time. I am sick to death of hearing people talk about that Nitro and Raw.
I want to talk more about the Nitros before, when you had things like Air Styles and Jason Jett and all that kind of crap. That was my WCW.
Yeah. WCW were kind of making like a little bit of a comeback quality wise, I remember, like in the dying days, like the couple of the last pay-per-views are actually pretty good, and they were, as you said, like Air Styles, they were bringing in new talent and stuff like
that. They had their cruiserweight tag team titles, god awful belts, but it was a good excuse for fun matches. But yeah, on the, like, all that stuff happening so recently, I, like, my literal first note on my document here is, welcome to the season finale of American Pro Wrestling.
This was it.
This is all over after this, guys.
Yeah. And then they've spent the next 20 years trying to recapture the era that this put the lid on.
Yeah. Yeah. It just was, like, because it is, like, literally... people kind of over egg historical moments in professional wrestling a lot, but like, this is definitely one of those where, like, I can trace it to the weeks immediately following this show. I started to notice friends weren't watching anymore. It dropped off precipitously.
In many ways, this match, I think, as you said, season finale, in many ways, and we'll get to it later, it is the much anticipated season finale of a TV episode, where they completely fuck up one of the dynamics, and in the seasons that follow, people don't care as much because the dynamic that sucked them in is gone.
Because not only is it not actually the end of American professional wrestling, it's not even their last match at a WrestleMania.
No. But, I mean, we're doing the end before the beginning, but like, yes. I completely understand Austin being burnt out. What more can that character do?
In the guise
that it was, like, he had been the ass-kicking babyface for 5 years. Solid years of doing exactly the same thing. And he was burnt out. And, like, Austin was, like, a workaholic and a perfectionist and that kind of thing. And, like, it must have just been just wrecking his brain.
And there was a thing where, like, you could have said, because he's only back since Survivor Series, and you could have said, give me a year, and then you can do your heel turn that you really want to do. But there's a certain extent to which I sympathize with the fact that, like, The Rock was about to go off and do his movie.
Yeah.
And I think everybody, even at the time, would have known, like, the window is closing on that guy being full-time. You've got, this might be obviously they did get to have another WrestleMania match, but, like, in your head, you'd be justified thinking, this is the last time we can do this.
But the story behind that one is nuts as well. Like, Austin pretty much dragged himself out of a hospital to the ring. Like, he was was in a very bad state.
The documentary that they released on the on the DVD about, like, how everybody nearly died on that WrestleMania show is incredible, because, like, Brock nearly died live on pay-per-view. Kurt Angle was in a near state of being crippled before the match even started. And then Austin as well. It's like, how that show came off as well as it did is a minor miracle.
Yeah, it's mad stuff. But, like, you can see at the end of this show, obviously this is the main event, it goes on last, and you can see at the end of this show, they are still in the mindset of, we have to hook them for tomorrow night. Which is something, I mean, it took a long time for them to get out of that mindset, I think, because for a long time, for people who did not live through the Monday Night Wars, the pay-per-views were secondary to the TV. What was driving revenue was TV ratings and ad sales during TV ratings over pay-per-view buys, which seems wild to think of now.
And it became a thing that I think WWF were slightly better than Eric Bischoff in WCW, who would constantly burn huge matches with no build on free TV.
Yeah.
So what WWF would do, they would still give you the big singles matches were on the pay-per-view, but you wouldn't get the storyline resolution on pay-per-view necessarily. Mm. It kind of felt like an episode of Lost. We answered one question, but posed three more on the pay-per-view, particularly during that initial Austin title run in 98-99, like when he was kind of back and forth on top, like, because it was just every time you thought, okay, he's finally gotten one up on the McMahons, there was just another wrinkle, and then every time you thought McMahon got a one up on him, it's all of a sudden, you know, Austin's back and he's like, Linda's brought him back, or, you know, whatever else, like, so they were slightly better at not burning the product, but it wasn't ideal.
It was the cash cow, you know, they had to keep it rolling. Mark, I'm pretty sure we've been through
another Limp Bizkit reference. I like it.
I'm pretty sure we have been through the numbers of nominations that both Rock and Austin have got when we've talked about them on previous shows. Feel free to recap if you would like, if this is for people for whom this is the first episode. This is WrestleMania 17, widely considered as one of, if not the greatest WrestleMania of all time. And I want to know, if you have that data to hand, how many matches from this one show got nominated?
Oh, my kind sir, I do have that information to hand.
I knew I could count on you.
I am almost certain, because there's maybe a couple that might possibly rival this, I'm almost certain this is the show with the most nominated matches from the project. Four matches are nominated. And, gentlemen, do you want to guess?
Well, I know we're going to be talking about one more.
Yeah.
That's still to come. Yes, there was a match on this show that was rated higher than this and is still to come in our countdown.
I think I could take a stab at three.
Go for it.
Well, bear in mind, this is the fourth.
This is one of them. So if you guess the three of us, then you win.
Nailed it. Nailed it. That's right. I was including this one in my three. I was getting an easy layup. TLC?
Yes. That is the one to come.
God, what have you already done? Angle Benoit? Is that on the list?
No, that is not. What? One of these had one nomination. So just to temper your expectations.
Is it Triple H Undertaker? Because it shouldn't be.
No. May I?
Yeah.
I'm not. I promise I'm not looking at the spreadsheet.
Yeah.
I think it is Vince versus Shane and the Hardcore Triple Threat.
Yes.
For comedy reasons.
I mean, the Hardcore Triple Threat, if only that they ran over the power cable and then he cut the pay-per-view feed.
Yeah. And then ran over Raven.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. The Rock's entrance, I'm looking at that thinking, is that where they crashed the golf buggy?
Any more fun facts and figures surrounding this match you want to regale us with, Mark?
This will be the last time we talk with The Rock. Not talk with The Rock. He's not a mystery guest.
I was just going to introduce him as the other guest on this call.
No, we don't have that budget, unfortunately.
No.
So this is our last of two Rock matches. He had 12 nominations. This is the only Austin match that we'll talk about after he broke his neck. Because we've got one Austin match left to come. And, well, we all know what that one is.
Spoilers, that will be our last show.
It's our last show.
That's the match that got over 30% of nominations from respondents. Yeah.
There are...
and got a couple of callbacks during this match.
Yep. There are seven WWF matches to come in this podcast series, and four of them take place at Mania.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
There we go.
Also, less stats, more... personal. This was not the first Mania that I watched. It's the first one I actually remember what the hell happened. Because WrestleMania 2000 is not exactly memorable.
He got so drunk.
But Mark, there was a McMahon in every corner.
That's all I remember, not the match, just the bloody tagline.
I ended up watching that show quite a lot because it was one I had on VHS at the time. And it's, you know, it was that era of you just rewatch what you had. There is no streaming service. There is no YouTube. Yeah. There is no, you know, if you want a wrestling show, it's 15 quid on VHS and you like it.
You made a calculated purchasing decision when you went down to the shop because you're like, whatever this is, I will be watching this for 6 months.
Well, I also would have been a PowerSlam purchaser and reader. Mm-hmm. So I would have read like Finn's review of the show beforehand before going and buying it. But like... The amount of times I watched WrestleMania 16, I also cannot remember a damn thing about it. So usually when we do big pay-per-view matches, I will watch the 4 weeks of TV to build beforehand. Didn't do that this time. What's the point when there is the My Way video package?
Yep.
Which, as I recall, does a much better job than the previous month of TV anyway.
Mostly because it ignores most of Deborah, I believe.
Yeah, well, yeah, I kind of want to talk about that.
A chunk of Deborah.
Yeah. Every time you rewatch the My Way video package on YouTube or whatever and you start getting hyped up again, you always forget in the middle, it goes, Mrs. Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah.
It's like, they did this subplot.
Yeah, it's real interesting. Like, is it the best hype package ever?
It's up there.
It's on the Mount Rushmore, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the few times WWE managed to grab onto something contemporary and cool because new metal, for better or worse, was hot shit in 2001. Limp Bizkit were massive off the back. So the previous year was both Chocolate Starfish and their song that was in for Mission Impossible.
It's the rare occasion where like WWE got like, or WWF at the time, got in association with a band and it was a big get. For WWE. Like, do you know what I mean? Usually it was the other way around. It's a band that really fucking needed the rub from wrestling.
Who the fuck are Florida Georgia Line or whatever they're called? Now, I'm perhaps going to commit heresy here. I've definitely cooled on it, I think. And I think that's because now I can look at it with a critical professional eye as a professional editor who has cut hype packages for pro wrestling.
Yeah.
For money. I can kind of see the flaws in it now. The Deborah part, as you mentioned, like that segment is shoehorned into that edit as much as the angle was into the story.
Yeah.
It brings the whole thing to a screeching halt.
It's so funny because then, like, when the strains of My Way come back in, you're like, oh, they got me again right at the end.
Yeah. So
if it had finished on the Deborah stuff, you'd be like, oh.
Yeah.
But I don't think, like, this company got close to this level of video package for another, like, probably until Running Up That Hill, maybe, for Taker and Sean. Did it make...
There is one other that we can't watch or listen to anymore, which was the Randy Orton Jeff Hardy one, because of the band who made the song that's in it, which is a real shame, because it's a phenomenal video.
Yeah.
Mark, I'll tell you later.
I was at a soft spot for the package for Survivor Series 2002, the Elimination Chamber with the Survivor or the Saliva song, because I was so on board with the Sean return. I think we talked about on the Sean angle episode that I was just like, I was just eating up anything Sean related at that time.
So I was looking, I was watching this video again today, and the editor is very clearly having to hype up the biggest match of the year with very little of substance to actually work with and no real story to tell, and does a great job by having a line from Austin about how it comes down to Rock has WWF title and he wants it, and he uses that line to clear the way and just make it about the two of them fighting for the belt.
Yeah.
But
the
footage is very thin on the ground. You see the same three angles of Rock stunning Austin three times, and the same confrontations are played over and over. But I got to kind of praise them, because, like, there, it's a bit of making chicken soup out of chicken shit.
So they had only, like, they'd only switched the title onto the Rock at No Way Out. So, like, they'd only, it was like six weeks or so that they had. And like you said, there was one memorable confrontation on Raw, another on SmackDown, and then they had the JR sit down interview. And those three things make up almost the entirety of this package.
Basically, we can sum up the entirety of the story here being: Austin wins the second best Royal Rumble of all time. Fight me, I'll die on that hill. Rock beats Angle at No Way Out for the title in a hell of a match that is spoiled a touch by Earl Hebner fucking the finish.
Good old Earl.
Yep. Vince tells Austin's wife, Deborah, that she's now managing the Rock in an angle that no party involved want anything to do with. And then it's just weeks of Austin and Rock staring at each other and then hitting each other with their own and each other's finishers. And then that sit down with Jim Ross.
Sit down is unbelievable, because it does a lot of the carrying for the story, and it's got that line in it that you kind of alluded to. Austin has that, like, I need to beat you, Rock, more than anything you could possibly imagine, and you're just like, holy crap, let's go.
One thing I'll say is, because for most of the ones where Kieran has gone through the build for, like, the big WWF matches with the big WWF video package on this podcast,
you've fallen asleep.
No. Mostly because I can't fall asleep easily. But anyway, no, the thing is, I'm always more hyped than Kieran is going into it, because I've just got the video package, which does a very good job of hiding the flaws of the build. Yes. And this is another good example.
You haven't had to drag yourself through a month of Raw with all the terrible mid-card shit going on as well.
As well as one of the greatest video packages of all time, it's maybe the greatest throw to a video package of all time. Because we talk about, I was mentioned earlier, like, it's the Goldilocks zone of maybe we're running out of time with The Rock that we can do this match again. But also, if this match had happened slightly earlier or a few months later, we would have had Jerry Lawler on commentary, but we didn't. We had Paul Heyman.
Yes. Instead, we had the best Attitude Era, the best peak 2000s peak commentary team of all time, because I will go to bat that Heyman and JR was the combination.
Unbelievable. And Heyman has that line right before the video package starts, where it's the match that both men need to win and neither man can afford to lose. It's just like, yes.
Speaking of lines, there's one line from the video package, which was, there can only be one World Wrestling Federation champion. And I'm thinking, just wait 19 months, Steve. Just 19 months. And then you got two of the fuckers.
I'm gonna enforce a minor correction. He actually channels Highlander and says, there can be only one. So now I want to see Steve Austin with a whacking great claymore in his hands, lopping people's heads off in New York. we might as well go straight into the match. Ross is taken aback at the announcement that this match is now no disqualification, which
I believe you'll find it's no disqualification in the strangest Finkel overemphasizing bit I've ever heard.
And yet that is not the strangest noise in this match.
No, we will come to that. We'll come to that. This was kind of, I'm trying to remember if this was in the middle of or started the period of the main event of a WWF pay-per-view suddenly becoming no DQ when it hadn't been announced as such beforehand. Because my recollection is throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, they did this a lot.
Yeah.
And it's simply because the guys are like, I don't fucking know what to do. Just hit each other with chairs and shit. Yeah.
I feel like it was a thing where, like, I still hate it and it's still dumb. And I feel like they got to it because it's like, we can't figure out a way to do the finish.
Mm.
Without a disqualification, so let's just get rid of disqualifications. But also, the way, if you listen to Paul Heyman's commentary during this match and some of the things he says about the no disqualification, it kind of works with, you know, finding out ultimately that McMahon was conspiring.
Yeah, you know, exactly. That,
like, how could it have possibly changed? Like, who could have the, you know, the stroke to change this this stip at the last minute? And it kind of makes sense, even though I still hate it.
It's good foreshadowing. Now, they kind of lay it on a little bit thick just towards the Vince reveal, but it's good foreshadowing, and I really like that element to it.
Mm.
And also, it perfectly plays into how Austin wrestles this match. It perfectly plays into Austin's ass-kicking character, because, of course, he's going to take advantage if he's given advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Austin is out to the Disturbed version of his theme. A pounding rendition of Glass Shatters. I love it, to be honest. I think it's great.
I have long been of the view, people may disagree, that it is the best version of his theme song, and that it may be one of the greatest wrestling theme songs of all time.
I might even still have my CD of Forcible Entry.
Yeah.
Unfortunate name, some cracking tracks on it though, particularly if you're into this era of rock and metal.
I was once at a show where they played that entire album start to finish, which was really cool until you got to a certain point in the middle of the album and you knew a certain song by Our Lady Peace was coming on next, and no one hit skip track, and everybody just had to stand there very awkwardly as that song played in its entirety.
I have actually seen Our Lady Peace live, and they did not play that song.
No, I'll bet they didn't.
I'm just glad that I have no clue what the fuck you're on about. I'm just happy.
Good. Yeah. I'll explain it to you later. Titanic pop, as you would expect for Austin in Texas. The amount of camera flashes as he climbs the corner needed an epilepsy warning.
I did a last quick screening of this as I was waiting around for the call. And I tweeted out, I was like, wrestling has never recovered from no one needing flashbulbs anymore. Because, like, just a sense of scale and spectacle, as like, you were watching something next level when, like, Austin hit the ring, or like Rock goes up on the top rope to do his pose with the belt, and just like the crowd just erupts in a series of flashes.
Yeah.
Like,
it makes it feel big time. Yeah, it's a moment that everybody wants to. It's a moment that everybody wants to spend at least one frame of celluloid that they have paid money for to capture forever.
Yeah,
I mean that's kind of over romanticizing it a bit, but. Yeah.
I feel like I maybe that was part of what they were trying to elicit years later with Bray Wyatt doing the Fireflies thing. It's like, get that idea of like the lights in the crowd amidst the darkness, and just give it that special kind of aura, because you took it so much for granted at the time, because it was all we had technologically, that it really took something away from wrestling when it was gone.
And it also says something that the entrance is pretty basic, but the sheer scale and the stakes, it still feels big, despite the fact it's just two guys coming out to their standard theme. No pyro, nothing fancy, no bells and whistles. But as you say, the flashes of the camera adds so much more. Mm. It probably adds more than pyro would have, to be honest.
Pyro, you can do in an empty building.
Yeah.
60,000 people taking a photo, you need 60,000 people for.
Yeah.
Rock goes up on the corner and gets the flash as well. And as he comes down, Austin just rips into him with punches. Mm. Rock ducks a belt shot, gets in some of his own, but takes the Fez press on what I called the sweary elbow a couple of times. Stone Cold ducks his head too early, though, allowing Rock to score with a neck breaker, and they each tease their finisher, but escape. And then Rock also hooks Steve for the stunner, but Austin flings him over the top rope. And Rock hits the ground pretty hard.
Oh, yeah.
He makes a big, meaty slapping noise.
Well, you can tell Rock's got his working boots on because the amount he was selling the elbow drops alone, like he was doing full 180-degree turnover cells. It was like he couldn't find a comfortable sleeping position.
I always got the vibe of Austin as like, if you didn't fancy selling his stuff at a 10 level, he was just going to hit you so that you would.
And you did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they fight over the barrier into the crowd and into the actual seats among lots of white men in the Target demo wearing baseball caps. Rock slams Austin's face into the announce table a couple of times before getting reversed on a whip and pulled into a clothesline I'm not sure he knew was coming, because it looks like he thinks he's going back to the barrier. And I think there's the remains of the Spanish announce table from when it got destroyed earlier in the night in the way. And Austin's just like, fuck it, I'm going to hit you.
Also, shout out to Paul Heyman, ever the pro. Whenever they're anywhere near that table, he grabs the modem or whatever the hell it is that his headphones plugged into to keep it out the way.
Yeah, yeah, it's his DI box for his headphones. Yeah, not as much as who's the one on the Spanish announce team who, whenever anybody comes within 10 feet of him, is over the barrier and in the third row. It's
Carlos.
It might be Carlos, yeah. Austin presses his advantage in the ring. He does I've written as Bozeman, so fuck it. The boss man rope stride and a superplex. The Rock is 28 years of age and headlining his third consecutive WrestleMania, says Jim Ross. Jesus Christ, that's a crazy stat.
That is an overachiever.
Yeah. Austin is 36 at this point, I think, and he headlined 98 and 99, but missed a McMahon in each corner due to injury.
His loss.
Also, he's what? He's only 12 years into his career.
Yeah.
Because he debuted in 89. So, yeah.
And Rock, let's not forget, only debuted... So he'd done some Memphis before, but Rock only debuted in the WWF in 96. End of 96. And it's something I was talking about recently. There's a famous exchange between two backstagers in the WWF, where one guy looks at Rocky and he's like, that guy's going to be headlining WrestleMania in 7 years. And the other guy goes, nah, I reckon he'll do it in 5. And he beat them all by doing it in 2.5.
Jesus.
Yeah. It's crazy. The star power just drips off him.
Yeah.
He makes a comeback with some fists, something that's supposed to be a clothesline, but is more like flying armpit to the face.
Yeah.
And a sort of belly to belly.
The ugliest belly to belly you've ever got.
I was like, was he going for a hip toss, realized he was out of place, tried to make it a belly to belly? Jim Ross, a god who is on form tonight, tries to his able best go, oh, what a Greco-Roman throw that was.
Yes. Yeah.
come on, Jim. Come on.
I just can't tell what his arms were doing. I tried replaying this and I just couldn't make sense of it.
To be fair, Austin with a surgically repaired neck and two busted wheels got up high for whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, but Rock's arms go out straight in front of him like he's expecting a towel over each one, rather than whenever he does a belly to belly, he never clasped his hands. Perhaps because it just would just let, with arms that big, would take too much time to clasp and then release and expect to let go of the guy. What got me about this, though, was the reactions to all of this. They were strong and they were mixed. It was high-pitched cheers followed by much bassier boos for everything he did in this little comeback.
Yeah.
And that would only get stronger as the match went on.
I think it's impressive as well that, we talked about him being 36 and, he's debuted in 1989, but the injuries and everything, he's got so many miles on the clock that it's impressive that this match goes as intense and as breathless as it does for us. It's really well into the back half of the match before they're taking lengthy breaks between bouts of action.
Yeah, but I don't know what the schedule was. I don't know how much house show stuff Austin was doing at the time, if he was just saving himself for the big stuff. But Steve Austin is one of those people you can't really accuse of half-assing it.
No.
like he would always go and give you, like, people have paid their money just for the full Stone Cold experience, particularly like at WrestleMania, and he's going to give it to him.
I mean, look, it's why it took him 19 years to finally agree to come back and do one more match, is like, because he didn't want to if he couldn't do it.
And that match was absolutely the best you could expect out of him, I think.
Yeah.
Like, he was still going to give it as much as he could. Yeah. I think that match is really good, to be honest.
Great.
I like it's
really
very
good.
Obviously, like, Owens carrying the load, but like he makes Austin look as good as possible.
Mm.
So they go back outside where Rock bounces Austin's face off the timekeeper's table a few times, and then rounds on Earl Hebner, who promptly falls backwards over the steps. And Rock somehow also seems to whack his shin on the corner of them. No idea how they managed that. Rocky then turns around into the ring bell to the face from Austin and does a big Hollywood behind the hairline to keep the face pretty blade job.
Yeah.
Timekeeper Mark Yeaton lives up to his name, being yeeted by Austin across ringside as he goes back to the bloody goes back to the Rock. All of this plays out in a single shot that goes over a minute, I noticed. There's none of this cutting on impact all the time.
Yeah.
Like, they hold this. And there's one bit where Rock is still down by the timekeeper's table, and you can see the cameraman turns to go back towards him and gets told, no, stay where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they let all this like run really nicely, I think.
Yeah, they do a really good job of hiding the blade job as well. The other than seeing Earl Hebner look for the blade, find the blade, and kind of half pick it up between shots.
Yeah.
So Steve batters Rocky all around ringside. Rock crawls up onto the commentary desk, which comically just falls apart underneath him. And it's like, it's not even what's going on in front of the camera. It's just like limply in the back of a shot.
Yeah, it's behind Hebner's shoulder, and you just see it go.
Pfft. Yeah, this is the point where they must have thought everything is going wrong, because like Hebner's fallen over, Rock's whacked his shin. They probably had a table spot planned, and now that thing's just fallen to pieces. I presume the weird noise you talked about, Mark, is the one that sounds like a cat being stepped on as Austin pulls Rock out of the wreckage.
Yeah, it's like, I have no clue what the hell it is. It's
like, so weird.
Is it a dolphin? Is it a parrot? Is it a cat? Is someone having a really squeaky fart? It's
be incredible if just in the second row there was a dolphin with a foam finger going nuts.
Somebody like under the announce table had stashed one of those Fisher Prize, like the cow goes moo toys, and just the Rock had mashed all the buttons at once. Getting off.
It's how Heyman keeps himself interested during the boring matches.
If you don't know what I mean, if you've got this match available, watch it, wait for the Rock to come out, and you will hear it, because it goes quite quiet.
It's very weird. Ross complains about their monitors not working anymore. Heyman says he has no choice to watch the Tron, and I know the edict is to call the monitor because that's what the audience are seeing, but the ring is right fucking there, lads, come on. Don't tell me you can't see this match anymore.
I loved Paul Heyman's line. I was like, I just got to watch the Tron. I have no other choice.
Yeah. Austin does a lot of punching. Rock makes a brief comeback, gets hit with a spinning neck breaker for a two count. Austin is just pounding on the cut. He stomps Rocky down in the corner and then just presses on him with a knee that's right in Dwayne's mouth. Like, he could probably taste that knee pad without too much difficulty.
And the camera gets in so close, you can tell the Rock did not have gingivitis in 2001.
Yeah, Britt Baker studying. So Steve walks away to remonstrate with the ref and turns around into an explosive lariat. It's like he's come out of a cannon off a single step as well.
He just like he would do this a lot, where he just like launched his entire body like a javelin. It was incredible.
And that is a big, heavy body as well. Like, people forget. So in a previous life, I worked a lot of movie premieres, and a couple of those were for movies that Dwayne Johnson was in. Let me tell you, he's a big boy. He is. Yeah. Large.
It's so funny that like in 2001, by the standards we would have at the time, he was unreasonably jacked. But now he looks out of shape compared to like how cut and ripped distinctly more middle-aged Dwayne is now.
Yeah,
looking much more well.
I did the premiere for, it was one of the two new Jumanji movies. So I'm the camera op, and I'm walking down to Leicester Square with my interviewer, and he was like, you know, the worst thing they could tell us is that Dwayne and Kevin Hart want to do their interviews together, because Dwayne is 6'5" and Kevin Hart is 5'6". We got down to our little slot on the red carpet and the PR came up and went, good news, Dwayne, Jack Black and Kevin want to do their interviews as a trio. So to get all of their heads in, I have the most aggressive Dutch tilt on my on my shot, just to make sure that all three heads appear in the frame.
Karen's shooting this like a Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah, pretty much. what happens? Oh, yeah. So there was that lariat. There was another one. Enormous boos and fling Steve into a turnbuckle that Austin exposed earlier so they can go 50-50 on the colour. Rock finally takes advantage of the no DQ stip by going and getting the bell and bashes Steve with it for a near fall.
Well, you say bashes. He waves it in Austin's general vicinity, because I'll say that the Rock did not go to the Stan Hansen School of Wrestling.
He is kinder to Austin's head than Austin was to his, because Austin definitely clocked him right in front of the camera.
And kinder than he had been to other men's heads in recent years.
Oh, God, yeah.
But the other thing that struck me was just, like, at the time, the board that the ring bell was stuck to was absolutely enormous. Like,
yes.
like unnecessarily so.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that, like, in hindsight, that the No Mercy 64 giant ring bell weapon that you could pull is like, oh, that's ridiculously huge. And then I watched this match back and I'm like, no, it was pretty accurate, actually.
Did you, as they hit each other with this, hear the No Mercy ding?
That's why you pick the ring bell every time.
Yeah, that and the low blow.
Yeah.
So the champion finally has the challenger in trouble some like 10 to 12 minutes into the match and is vastly unpopular for doing so.
Yeah.
Outside, though, Austin turns it around again and there is a gross shot where he hooks Rock for a catapult into the post and you can see and hear his blood drip off his face into Dwayne's eyes.
Oh,
it's horrible. So Rock hits the post, gets battered back towards comms, and we can see the two commentary teams just as four blokes looking at TVs on the floor in the aftermath of an earthquake, because like both tables are destroyed and there's just like cables and tech and monitors all over the place.
At a certain point in the Attitude Era, I think like maybe commentators were going, would you please destroy the two tables, because now like breaking down the ring after the pay-per-view is easier if the thing's already in bits.
I think I remember reading or seeing that the tables, the kind of pod tables they've had for like the 20 years now, with like the panel to cover the gear and all that kind of thing, they have kind of like bolts in them, and when there's a table spot coming, like JR and the King just flick their bolts and get out of the way, and then it's just down to whatever dowel is in there to crack and the thing to fall apart. So Brock takes a monitor in the face from Austin and a blade into his hand from Hebner, because apparently we need even more blood. This was the one where you could see pretty much all of it. Like, if you don't watch Austin's side of the screen, watch the other side of the screen and watch these two idiots try and pass this piece of metal between them. And then Rock roll over, twirl it around in his hands to get it the right way, and then go for his forehead. I completely missed that.
Now, random noises I can get.
Yeah, yeah. You handle sound, I'll handle picture.
The rusty gate replay noise, which is embedded in my brain. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Back inside again, Austin flips the double bird, kicks us out the stunner, but Rock catches the foot, decks him, and puts on what I have dubbed the shark shooter, the worst scorpion deathlock of all time.
Oh, it's flipping terrible.
He is completely unable to cross Austin's leg and just sort of ends up in some kind of like one-armed Boston crab type situation with both feet just tucked under an arm.
Given how they probably still felt about him at the time, I just like feel like the company were quite happy for him to do a tremendously bad sharpshooter just to annoy Brett.
Yeah, I mean, the quality of this sharpshooter was like it was cast in the A-Team.
The thing about though is at the time, like when he does this spot and there's like that initial house, like, God, that's a terrible sharpshooter, but then like the penny drops with you what they're doing, like what they're echoing, like when they do the reverse shot of Austin and then you're like you're just back in and you're losing it.
I had a question. Has The Rock ever actually won a match with the Scorpion King Deathlock? because the crowd here are screaming like he's Sting, Bret, and Ricky Choshu all rolled into one, and Austin is done for.
Yeah, I don't remember him ever doing it, so it makes me feel like maybe a lot more of this crowd than you would have expected got exactly what the reference was.
Yeah, so as you've alluded to, it is the reference to Austin being trapped in it at WrestleMania 13 and that classic shot of him pressing up and screaming with the blood streaming down his face. The close-up of each man's faces here streaming blood are both superb. Particularly Rock's, actually, I think, because Austin has the typical crimson mask like blood going on, but Rock's is kind of all like streaming in rivulets down one side of his face and going through his mouth. Looks incredible. Yeah.
Is it wrong to say there's maybe a slightly greasy quality to, like, so it kind of, it's got that kind of water on grease element to it, so it looks better.
It's almost theatrical in terms of like the spread and also the color. Like, it's just that right light that you're like, it's almost animated. That's how much the red pops.
The trick I was always told is pop a lot of aspirin, because that's a blood thinner.
A thinner, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's how you get, instead of like big gloops, that's how you get it to flow well. Austin gets to the ropes and Rock is made to break. Where do we stand on rope breaks in no disqualification matches?
Good point.
Not ideal. So what do you do when you get to five? You go, hey, stop it.
Yeah, yeah. So I realized watching this that I have a direct line to a professional wrestling referee who I can ask. So I did indeed ask.
Earl Hebner.
No, Charles Wheeler of Wrestling Resurgence. And he says, assuming it's not also false count anywhere, the correct answer would be a submission no longer counts, but the official can't force a break. Reaching or breaking the plane of the ropes is exiting the ring, and the finish to a no DQ match that isn't false count anywhere must occur in the ring. So I asked, could the referee in theory not administer the five count, but refuse to rule a submission if the defender taps out? So they can't punish the attacker by calling for a break or disqualifying them, but they can punish the attacker and the defender via pain, obviously, by refusing to call a win. And he said, that would be exactly correct. However, we don't punish, we just arbitrate.
Yeah. Because then you get into the, like, what if he had passed out in the sharpshooter and then he just pins him?
But yes, the official line is, you shouldn't do this.
No.
No. So Rock tries for a second, but gets kicked off and locked in Austin's own, for a brief moment, superior sharpshooter. Rock, though, has big meaty thighs and is able to use his leg strength to push his way free. He does need the ropes to break a second, but Stone Cold just flips off Hebner and keeps it applied a bit longer before just eventually letting go. I would have liked if he'd just sat there for another minute.
Which is interesting, because it's like, obviously where the match was going, like, we've got a heel turn coming at the end of this match. And like, you wonder if it was like, let's see how they'll react if I start acting like a dick. And it just turns out it's Texas. He's still beloved. So yes, kill him. Kill him more.
You say that. I know it's no DQ. He's the first person to use weapons. He's the first person to bring a foreign object into the match, and he does it really quickly.
Yeah.
He jumps a Rock. So really, throughout the whole match, you can argue that if this was someone that wasn't Steve Austin, if this was Joe Bloggs versus Mike whatever,
let
me just write those names down.
Austin would be the heel.
Yeah.
Austin would be the heel because of how he's wrestling.
Yeah. But yeah, that is the caveat that it's Steve Austin. So like, up until the point where it's like, oh, that's just unsportsmanlike. He hasn't done anything that's out of character.
No, not at all. Austin clamps on the $1 million dream, the Cobra Clutch, prompting Jim Ross to bring up the ringmaster. And like, you don't have to, man. It's just, you could just say he used to use this. You don't have to name the ringmaster. I suffered through that in real time.
Yeah, there was no one in this building that was happier to see the $1 million dream than Jim Ross.
No.
He loved it.
I don't think anybody else in the building remembered the ringmaster. Nobody gave a shit.
I think there was a smattering of...
Yeah.
So we do the old 2.5 drops of the arm before Rock does the push off the turnbuckles reversal for a pinfall. Near fall, not a pinfall. Jesus Christ, that would have been different. Rock then hits a stunner and Houston is pissed. Steve kicks out and Houston is elated. And then Vince comes out and Houston is pissed again.
Let's all remark upon the recovery powers of Vince McMahon, who had his bollocks kicked into near orbit about an hour and a half previous. Who, like, still including this match, maybe the biggest pop on the show, Linda getting out of the chair.
Yeah. I will say the bollock situation probably explains the sheer lack of expression on his face for multiple points of the next 5 minutes.
And the way he's walking down the ramp.
The bollock situation is my favourite ska band.
So, in the ring, Austin gets a 2.85 off a spine buster, and then Rock hits his own, followed by the people's elbow, and Vince pulls him off the cover.
You knew, I was disappointed that they did the rare facing the entrance ramp people's elbow, because as soon as he did it from that angle, you're like, my shenanigans. Mm. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't do, like, Vince couldn't just pivot around 90 degrees so that he could be in position from the normal spot to do it. But, you know,
well, it's because of what comes next, where it's so they can get a full lap of Rock chasing Vince around the ring before Vince gets into the ring. Rock, who's in hot pursuit, winds up in the path of Steve Austin doing a rock bottom that brings the whole building to its feet.
It was a great, because it's, again, playing into what would then happen later. That's that moment of plausible deniability where the crowd are like, did Vince set that up? Or was Austin just like going, no, I'll deal with him after and I'm going to prioritize The Rock now. Yeah. And the way The Rock smoothly runs directly into the arm rising up from Austin is just, it's picture perfect.
Yeah.
Though I could have done with a couple more laps of Vince running away because I did enjoy that.
It doesn't have a particularly cartoonish run.
Yeah. Need to edit over like Zoidberg doing the whoop 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 as he's running.
I was fucking thinking that about 10 seconds before you said that. It's, like,
It's also a good rock bottom as well. Like, he gets him up. Rocky, he's not going to make his own finishing move look like shit. He goes 8 feet in the air for this thing. Like, it's the giant choke slamming Rey Mysterio Jr. So that doesn't get the win. Austin goes for the stunner, but Rock pushes him off. Austin lightly grazes Earl Hebner, who goes into ironing board mode again and stiffly falls out of the ring. Austin low blows Rock and gets Vince to come in with a chair. Rocky smartly gets a hand up to stop this old buffoon concussing him with the chair just before he's about to go and shoot a movie.
Yep.
And then kicks out of the pin when McMahon rolls Hebner back in. At this point, in the version I watch, the audio is very clearly altered to cover Austin's tsunami of F-bombs. So Steve takes up the chair himself and is in position to strike, but Rock pops up from his knees and hits the rock bottom.
This is fantastic. The way it's perfect.
Yeah, yeah. You can say one thing about these two. They sure got some chemistry.
Yeah.
Vince takes Hebner to stop him counting, but awkwardly gets pulled into the ring by Rock and peppered with punches. And then Rock turns around into a stunner and does his classic back roll into a handstand bump for it. Yep. But kicks out. Home run chair shot to the face. Another kick out. And I had to laugh because Austin sits up with his bottom lip sticking out every time he exhales. And he looks like a blood-soaked beaker from the Muppets.
There was a great moment where he had I think it was when he was being forced to do the rope break, that he just kind of looks down the barrel of the camera with this maniacal grin while he's covered. Like, his facial expressions in this match are just top tier.
Mm. There is more audio manipulation to remove some naughty words. Then Austin hits Rock with 16 consecutive chair shots to the body while he's down and scores the pin. And Houston goes fucking bananas in celebration. Yep. They are so happy.
Also, one thing I want to point out, from Vince coming out to the finish, in fact, from Vince grabbing the Rock's leg to the finish, there was 5 minutes that Vince was involved. 5 minutes.
Mm.
And I just mentioned that because, for me, I think it just took way too long. Because, as you say, the crowd reaction, you're not getting the boos for Austin winning. You're not getting that. And I just wonder, if they'd have condensed it all and Vince was only involved for the 16 chair shots, would it have been more effective?
Yeah, because there's the thing. I think it's Meltzer has often said it, that like, in your attempt to design a finish that would turn Austin heel, unfortunately in Houston, what you did was make Vince McMahon the number two babyface in the company. Because they were like, whatever it takes for Austin to win, we're down with it.
I think it was very fortunate that WrestleMania was in Houston and a Texas guy was going for the world title in terms of drawing. I think it was very unfortunate that WrestleMania was in Houston when they decided to turn the Texas guy heel in the main event.
You can hear millions of dollars incinerated.
Yeah. So Austin takes the belt from Earl and shakes hands with Vince. His Faustian bargain is complete. And we get celebrations, beer, whack Rocky with the belt just for fun, and we're out of there. When this was finished, I had one question, which was, why and how is it in an art form and a storytelling medium where you can create and portray any character, and God knows this industry has had its fair share of actual costume superheroes, that two men in black boots and black trunks feels like two celestial beings fighting for the fate of the universe?
It comes down to that thing where, like, pro wrestling is really simple and people just overcomplicate it so much.
Because, by adding Deborah, for example.
But did you not hear the promo? Bam, she's a non-factor. That's what Steve told us.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just simple. Like you said, even with the bill that was like maybe a couple of TV angles really hammed up in that all-timer video package, like the majority of this story was told in the ring, and it does it is a match that start to finish is larger than life. It's one of the times where I imagine if you're a younger fan and you hear like old farts like us talk about this match and then you tune into it for the first time, you still get how big it was. We're not overselling it at all.
I mean, we're now the old farts that were young kids when the generation or so before us were talking about Hogan versus Andre, and we tuned into that and were massively disappointed.
Yeah.
So Dave, you're obviously here because you picked this as part of your list. I didn't even ask you the reasons why. I mean, I probably should have.
It's the most it might be the most straightforward, one of the most straightforward ones you ever do. It's is one of the most important matches in our entire lifetime, and it's the crest of the wave that is the most popular American pro wrestling has ever been and probably will ever be. Like, both of the major companies now are easily outgrossing what WWF did in 2000 at the or 2001 at the gates and stuff like that. In terms of money, they're making way more now, but in terms of just eyeballs on the product and people talking about it and it being a pop culture phenomenon, it was never ever bigger than this, and I would be shocked if in my lifetime it ever will be as big as this.
And I was looking at the TV ratings, and I think even 2001 was actually slightly starting to come down compared to 2000.
Yeah.
I mean, this was like the flatline period. You can argue, you can really see it start to drop 2002 and even a few months after this. But you're right. This is the crest of the wave. This is the peak. This is the more people have cared about wrestling in the 20th century. It is the peak of this century.
There are people who, unlike us, made the smart decision and got out in 2001 and still to this day, I know people who this is very much the case for, who have not watched wrestling in 20 years or so. But if you're ever in a situation where someone sticks on My Way, they get chills. To make a song like that, like a Limp Bizkit song, emotionally resonant to people after two decades is unbelievable.
I also put this on my list, and I picked it not for match quality, although I think it is a good match, particularly for this style and this era, but because, as we said at the beginning, this marks the end of the Attitude Era. This is a flag in the top of the mountain. Like, we went over like the closure of the two rival promotions and WWF hoovering them up, like, and then from here we go into the invasion and ruthless aggression.
I'm sorry, you're forgetting the important middle chapter of the two-man power trip.
Oh, fuck me.
That begins the following night.
Christ.
I mean, the thing is, this was the biggest Mania main event since Bret Austin. The next big one is probably 2005.
Yeah, Bret and Austin is not the main event of that WrestleMania.
Oh, is it not?
No. Mark, pick two people out of a hat. Who do you think goes on last at WrestleMania 13?
Oh, fuck. Shawn Michaels?
And who would be his opponent?
Well, it's not Shawn Taker because they had theirs. I ain't got a for Scooby.
Okay. It's The Undertaker and Sid.
Yeah. Shawn Michaels was out with a metal detector looking for a smile at the time, I believe.
Not a sniffer dog.
That man did not want sniffer dogs anywhere near his property in 1996 and 97. No,
they would have had seizures.
A lot of comics and sci-fi have the concept of the Nexus event, the inevitable event around which all else flows, and you can try and bend time and space and reality itself, and that event will always happen. And for me, this is that for American wrestling. Like, this is inevitable. This was always going to happen, and this is, like, the fulcrum around which everything up to has led up to, and then everything since has fallen away from.
And this is like, if you talk about their trilogy of matches at WrestleMania, this happens right in the middle. The first one, The Rock is still ascendant. Like, he's still on the way up. He's not fully solidified as the top, top guy. The next one that happens, as much as I do have a real soft spot for that match, both of them are on the way out the door, and at least one of them is completely washed physically at the time. So this is, again, like you said, it's that perfect moment. You'll never get to, even though Houston treated them differently, they were both baby faces. You will never get two baby faces on this level at the same time having a match like this that also delivers in the ring.
Very quickly, their first WrestleMania one, though, does have one of my favourite goofy spots where Rock takes one of the handheld cameras and starts filming and then turns around and gets Austin's face, and Austin boots him in the gut and gives him the stunner while he's still holding the camera.
One of the greatest camera shots in the history of wrestling was done by Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah. Mark, do you have anything else to add? Like, Dave and I have waxed poetic about why we like this and why we picked it.
So I just want to say, the execution of this match at various times is lacking. The Rock sharpshooter, as we said, his sharpshooter missed the bullseye. There's daylight between a lot of these weapon shots. The table collapsed out of embarrassment. Honestly, this is up there with one of the worst executed matches on this list. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because this is a perfect example of, if you've got the right crowd, if you've got the right connection to the wrestlers, and if you've got the right level of charisma, it doesn't matter how many mistakes happen, because how many mistakes have we gone through in this match? People falling over, things falling over, people failing to pass bits of metal coherently. And all of these elements do not matter. People don't remember them. What they remember is the big moments. What they remember is what they felt. And this is a perfect example of modern. I think the general level of execution in wrestling goes through peaks and troughs. I think we're actually at a generally quite high level of, like, the level of ability of wrestlers in, say, 2023 is a lot higher than it was, maybe not at this point, but for a lot of wrestling in the last 30 odd years. But I don't think you always need that level of perfect execution. And this is the example, because you can literally just list down all the mistakes and it doesn't matter, because the emotional connection, the sheer specialness of it, it's an event. It is an event, and it's perfect.
There's the refrain I often talk about in Days of Thunder from Death of WCW, where, like, when something is hot, there's almost nothing you can do that will ruin that. And, like, WCW is a perfect example. When that was at its hottest and people had the biggest emotional connection with it, almost all of those main events are some of the worst professional wrestling matches you will ever see.
Yes.
But it didn't matter. And this was, like you said, Mark, it was a right balance, because, like, it's good enough.
Yeah.
And also it is, like, nuclear hot.
Yeah, it's characters and story all, like, hitting at the right time. And as we said, you know, it's a pop culture thing. And, an incredible moment. So Uncle Dave Meltzer gave this 4.5 stars. It sits at 9.36 on Cage Match. WrestleMania 17 was the best major show in the Observer Awards, and Austin won Best on Interviews, Best Brawler, second in Wrestler of the Year. Rock and Austin were 1 and 2 in Most Charismatic. Like, they kind of swept the board in terms of like the Westerners. At the time, this show had the second highest attendance of all time in the US behind WrestleMania 3, both in terms of number of people in the building and number of tickets sold. And did over 1 million buys worldwide on pay-per-view, of which the US accounted for 970,000. It is still the sixth highest buy rate for a WWE pay-per-view. So there we go. If we're all wrapped on Rock and Austin, I would like to thank Dave for joining us once again. Please take the floor and tell us what is going on at alargemanappears.com.
Well, firstly, guys, thank you so much for having me yet again. It's always good to get out of the depths of WCW to talk about something from my list. So I really something always competent. Appreciate the invite. Yeah, so as the lad said, I'm the host of Days of Thunder over on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, where we're going chronologically through every episode of Thunder and every WCW pay-per-view from start to finish. We are in the back half of 1999, finally. By the time this drops, we've probably are just about to or have just done Road Wild 99, which is a very infamous pay-per-view. Dennis Rodman's last WCW match, and one where a number of people were feared missing and or dead on the motorcycle ride to Sturgis that year. So it's a really fun time. We're a couple of months away from Jeff Jarrett and Vince Russo arriving. So you can tune in now for all that. And yeah, behind our paywall at alargemanappears.com for just €5 a month, you can get plenty of extra stuff. We do a series where we're rewatching all the Clash of the Champions shows. We do listener requests. If you bump up to our top tier, you can basically make us watch anything from a good wrestling show, imagine that, to a Jackie Chan movie where he's just like borderline just showing hog for half the movie. So yeah, a lot of wild and crazy things going on there, as well as like draft shows and different bits and pieces. We do solo audio talking about current day wrestling and stuff like that. It's a good time. You should come check it out. Try us out by just searching Days of Thunder on your podcast app and you'll find us and see what you think of the show. Thank you.
And where do we find you on the socials?
Yes, so the podcast is at WCW Thunderpod and I am at The Day to Dave.
Fantastic. We are at Must See Matches on Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, Threads, and Blue Sky. You can go to linktr.ee/mustseematches for all the ways to subscribe, links to the full list of nominations, and a whole load more. We also have a Discord. Hit bit.ly/mustseematches Discord and come and have a chat. And I, about an hour ago, 2 hours ago, put out the call saying, hey, we're doing this tonight, and if you put your thoughts in here, I will read them out. Totally forgot to open Discord, so I've got no idea what anybody said, if anything. And because I'm on a new computer, Discord won't open. Right, fuck this. I am at Kieran Edits, and Mark is?
At Monkey_Buckles.
And quickly, before I forget, if you've not heard enough of me, I am on the latest episode of What's on the Telly on ProRes Paradise. If you're a Torch VIP subscriber, Alan Forel had me on and we talked about two TV shows from the month of September across history. I brought him Dragon Gate Infinity number 3, which is a favorite episode of mine of Dragon Gate. And he brought me the September 22nd, 1997 episode of Monday Night Raw, the first ever Raw live from Madison Square Garden. So if you are a Torch VIP, go check that out. Next week, we go to Mexico for the first time. EMLL, MS1 versus Sangre Chicana in a 2 hour three falls hair versus hair match from September the 23rd, 1983. And so that will be the 40th anniversary of that match. And joining us will be the wonderful Palm Singh man making his return to the show. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
You live a little bit with the pain that I bring, you know. know it's only the beginning. Strap up, cause you're the next one in line for the kill. You don't believe it, but I'm betting that you will. Strap up, I'll let you live a little bit with the pain that I bring. You know it's only the beginning. I'm breaking up.